poisons which, if not released, could be as deadly as the real kind. The nurse sat beside his bed. "I'm a widow," she told him.
"Vietnam?"
"Yes, Tim was a captain in the 1st Cavalry."
"I'm sorry," Kelly said without turning his head. "They saved my butt once."
"It's hard, I know.
Last November I lost Tish, and now..."
"Sarah told me."
"Mr. Kelly?"
"John," he said softly.
He couldn't find it in himself to be gruff with her.
"Thank you, John. My name is Sandy." "Bad luck does not make a bad person," she told him in a voice that meant what it said, though it didn't quite sound that way.
"It wasn't luck. She told me it was a dangerous place, and I took her there anyway because I wanted to see for myself."
"You almost got yourself killed trying to protect her."
"I didn't protect her, Sandy. I killed her." Kelly's eyes were wide open now, looking at the ceiling. "I was careless and stupid, and I killed her."
"Other people killed her, and other people tried to kill you. You're a victim."
"Not a victim, just a fool." "We'll save that for later," Nurse O'Toole told herself.
"What sort of girl was she, John?"
"Unlucky." Kelly made an effort to look at her face, but that just made it worse. He gave the nurse a brief synopsis of the life of Pamela Starr Madden, deceased.
"So, after all the men who hurt her or used her, you gave her something that nobody else did."
O'Toole paused, waiting for a reply and getting none.
"You gave her love, didn't you?"
"Yes." Kelly's body shuddered for a moment. "Yes, I did love her."
"Let it out," the nurse told him. "You have to."
First he closed his eyes. Then he shook his head. "I can't." This would be a difficult patient, she told herself. The cult of manhood was a mystery to her. She'd seen it in her husband, who had served a tour in Vietnam as a lieutenant, then rotated back again as a company commander. He hadn't relished it, hadn't looked forward to it, but he hadn't shrunk from it. It was part of the job, he'd told her on their wedding night, 2 months before he'd left. A stupid, wasteful job that had cost her a husband and, she feared, her life. Who really cared what happened in a place so far away? And yet it had been important to Tim. Whatever that force had been, its legacy to her was emptiness, and it had no more real meaning than the grim pain she saw on the face of her patient. O'Toole would have known more about that pain if she'd been able to take her thought one step further.
"That was really stupid."
"That's one way of looking at it," Tucker agreed. "But I can't have my girls leaving without permission, can I?"
"You ever hear of burying them?"
"Anybody can do that."
The man smiled in the darkness, watching the movie. They were in the back row of a downtown theater, a 1930s film palace that was gradually falling to ruin, and had started running films at 9 a.m. just to keep up with the painting bill. It was still a good place for a covert meeting with a confidential informant, which was how this meeting would go on the officer's timesheet.
"Sloppy not killing the guy, too."
"Will he be a problem?" Tucker asked.
"No, he didn't see anything, did he?"
"You tell me, man.
I can't get that close to the case, remember?"
The man paused for a handful of popcorn and munched away his irritation. "He's known to the department. Ex-Navy guy, skin diver, lives over on the eastern shore somewhere. Sort of a rich beach bum, from what I gather. The first interview didn't develop anything at all. Ryan and Douglas are going to be working the case now, but it doesn't look like they have much of anything to work with."
"That's about what she said when we talked to her. He picked her up, and it looks like they had a mighty good time together. But her supply of pills ran out, she said. And she had him bring her in town to score some lewds. So, no harm done?"
"Probably not, but let's try to control loose ends, okay?"
"You want me to get him in the hospital?" Tucker asked lightly. "I can probably arrange that."
"No!
You damn fool, this is going on the books as a robbery. If anything else happens, it just gets bigger. We don't want that. Leave him be. He doesn't know anything."
"So he's not a problem?"
Tucker wanted to be clear on that. No. But try to remember that you can't open a murder investigation without a body. I have to keep my people in line. From what I hear you did to her, just keeping them in line, Tucker reemphasized. Making an example, like. You do that right and you don't have any more problems for a while. You're not a part of that. Why does it bother you? Another handful of popcorn helped him bend to the logic of the moment. What do you have for me? Tucker smiled in the darkness. Mr. Piaggi is starting to like doing business with me. A grunt in the darkness. I wouldn't trust him. It does get complicated, doesn't it? Tucker paused. But I need his connections. We're about to hit the big time. How long? Soon, Tucker said judiciously. Next step, I think, we start feeding stuff north. Tony is up there talking to some people today, matter of fact. What about now? I could use something juicy. Three guys with a ton of grass good enough? Tucker asked. Do they know about you? No, but I know about them. That was the point, after all. His organization was tight. Only a handful of people knew who he was, and those people knew what would happen if they got a little loose. You just had to have the stones to enforce discipline. Take it easy on him, Rosen said outside the private room. He's recovering from a major injury, and he's still on several medications. He's really not capable of talking to you with a full deck. I have my job too, Doctor. It was a new officer on the case now, a detective sergeant named Tom Douglas. He was about 40 and looked every bit as tired as Kelly, Rosen thought, and every bit as angry. I understand that, but he's been badly hurt, plus the shock of what happened to his girlfriend. The quicker we get the information we need, the better our chances are to find the bastards. Your duty is to the living, sir. Mine is to the dead. If you want my medical opinion, he's not really capable of helping you right now. He's been through too much. He's clinically depressed, and that has implications for his physical recovery. Are you telling me that you want to sit in? Douglas asked. Just what I need, an amateur Sherlock to watch over us. But that was a battle he couldn't win and wouldn't bother to fight. I'll feel better if I can keep an eye on things. Go easy on him, Sam repeated, opening the door. Mr. Kelly, we're sorry, the detective said after introducing himself. Douglas opened his notebook. The case had been booted up the ladder to his office because of its high profile. The first page color photo on the Evening Sun had come as close to the pornographic as anything the media could publish, and the mayor had personally called for action on this one. Because of that, Douglas had taken the case, wondering how long the mayor's interest would last. Not very, the detective thought. The only thing that occupied a politician's mind for more than a week was getting and holding votes. This case had more spin on it than one of Mike Quaylar's screwballs. But it was his case, and what was always the worst part was about to take place. Two nights ago, you were in the company of a young lady named Pamela Madden? Yes. Kelly's eyes were closed when Nurse O'Toole came in with his morning antibiotic dose. She was surprised to see the two other men there and stopped in the doorway, not knowing if she should interrupt or not. Mr. Kelly, yesterday afternoon we discovered the body of a young woman who fits the physical description of Miss Madden. Douglas reached into his coat pocket. No, Rosen said, getting out of his chair. Is this she? Douglas asked, holding the photo before Kelly's face, hoping that his proper grammar would somehow lessen the impact. God damn it! The surgeon turned the cop around and pushed him against the wall. In the process, the photo dropped on the patient's chest. Kelly's eyes went wide in horror. His body sprang upwards, fighting the restraints. Then he collapsed, his skin pasty white. All in the room turned away but for the nurse, whose eyes were locked on her patient. Look, Doc, Douglas tried to say. Get the hell out of my hospital, Rosen fairly screamed. You can kill somebody with that kind of shock. Why didn't you tell me? He has to identify. I could have done that. O'Toole heard the noise as the two grown men scuffled like children in a playground. But John Kelly was her concern, the antibiotic medication still in her hand. She tried to remove the photograph from Kelly's view, but her own eyes were first drawn to the image and then repulsed by it as Kelly's hand seized the print and held it a scant 12 inches from his own wide-open eyes. It was his expression now that occupied her consciousness. Sandy recoiled briefly at what she saw there, but then Kelly's face composed itself, and he spoke. "It's okay, Sam. He has his job to do, too." Kelly looked down at the photo one last time. Then he closed his eyes and held it up for the nurse to take. And things settled down for everyone except Nurse O'Toole. She watched Kelly swallow the oversized pill and left the room for the calm of the corridor. Sandra O'Toole walked back to the nurse's station, remembering what she alone had seen. Kelly's face turning so pale that her first reaction to it was that he must be in shock. Then the tumult behind her as she reached for her patient. But then what? It wasn't like the first time at all. Kelly's face had transformed itself. Only an instant, like opening a door into some other place, and she'd seen something she had never imagined. Something very old and feral and ugly. The eyes not wide, but focused on something she could not see. The pallor of his face, not that of shock, but of rage. His hands balled briefly into fists of quivering stone. And then his face had changed again. There had been comprehension to replace the blind, killing rage. And what she'd seen next was the most dangerous sight she had ever beheld, though she knew not why. Then the door closed. Kelly's eyes shut, and when he opened them, his face was unnaturally serene. The complete sequence had not taken 4 seconds, she realized, all of it while Rosen and Douglas had been scuffling against the wall. He'd passed from horror to rage to understanding, then to concealment. But what had come in between comprehension and disguise was the most frightening thing of all. What had she seen in the face of this man? It took her a moment to answer the question. Death was what she'd seen. Controlled. Planned. Disciplined. But it was still death, living in the mind of a man. "I don't like doing this sort of thing, Mr. Kelly," Douglas said back in the room as he adjusted his coat. The detective and the surgeon traded a look of mutual embarrassment. "John, are you all right?" Rosen looked him over and took his pulse quickly, surprised to find it nearly normal. "Yeah," Kelly nodded. He looked at the detective. "That's her. That's Pam." "I'm sorry. I really am," Douglas said with genuine sincerity. "But there's no easy way to do this. There never is. Whatever happened, it's over now, and now it's our job to try and identify the people who did it. We need your help to do that." "Okay," Kelly said neutrally. "Where's Frank? How come he's not here?" "He can't have a hand in this," Sergeant Douglas answered, with a look to the surgeon. "He knows you. Personal involvement in a criminal case isn't terribly professional." It wasn't entirely true. In fact, was hardly true at all. But it served the purpose. "Did you see the people who..." Kelly shook his head, looking down at the bed, and he spoke just above a whisper. "No, I was looking the wrong way. She said something, but I didn't get around. Pam saw them. I turned right, then started turning left. I never made it." "What were you doing at the time?" "Observing." "Look, you talked to Lieutenant Allen, right?" "That's correct." Douglas nodded. "Pam witnessed a murder. I was bringing her in to talk to Frank about it." "Go on." "She was linked up with people who deal drugs. She saw them kill somebody, a girl. I told her she had to do something about it. I was curious about what it was like," Kelly said in a flat monotone, still bathing in his guilt while his mind replayed the image. "Names?" "None that I remember," Kelly answered. "Come on," Douglas said, leaning forward. "She must have told you something." "I didn't ask much. I figured that was your job. Frank's job, I mean. We were supposed to meet with Frank that night. All I know is it's a bunch of people who deal drugs and who use women for something. That's all you know? Kelly looked him straight in the eyes. Yes. Not very helpful, is it? Douglas waited a few seconds before going on. What might have been an important break in an important case was not going to happen. And so it was his turn to lie again, beginning with some truth to make it easier. There's a pair of robbers working the west side of town. Two black males, medium size, and that's all we have for a description. Their M.O. is a sawed-off shotgun. They specialize in taking down people coming in for a drug buy, and they particularly like the gentry customers. Probably most of their robberies don't even get reported. We have them linked to two killings. This might be number three. That's all? Rosen asked. Robbery and murder are major crimes, Doctor.
But that's just an accident.
That's one way of looking at it, Douglas agreed, turning back to his witness. Mr. Kelly, you must have seen something. What the hell were you doing around there? Was Miss Madden trying to buy something?
No.
Look, it's over. She's dead. You can tell me. I have to know. Like I said, she was linked up with this bunch, and I, dumb as it sounds, I don't know shit about drugs. I'll be finding out, though. Alone in his bed, alone with his mind, Kelly's eyes calmly surveyed the ceiling, scanning the white surface like a movie screen. First, the police are wrong, Kelly told himself. He didn't know how he knew, but he did, and that was enough. It wasn't robbers, it was them, the people Pam was afraid of. What had happened fit what Pam had told him. It was something they had done before. He had allowed himself to be spotted, twice. His guilt was still quite real, but that was history now, and he couldn't change it. Whatever he had done wrong, it was done. Whoever had done this to Pam, they were still out there. And if they'd done this twice already, they would do it again. But that was not really what occupied his mind behind the blank, staring mask. Okay, he thought. Okay. They've never met anyone like me before. I need to get back into shape, Chief Bosun's mate, John Terence Kelly, told himself. The injuries were severe, but he'd survive them. He knew every step of the process. Recovery would be painful, but he'd do what they told him. He'd push the envelope a little bit, enough to make them proud of their patient. Then the really hard part would start. The running, the swimming, the weights. Then the weapons training. Then the mental preparation. But that was already underway, he realized. Oh no. Not in their wildest nightmares have they ever met anyone like me. The name they had given him in Vietnam boiled up from the past. Snake. Kelly pushed the call button pinned to his pillow. Nurse O'Toole appeared within 2 minutes. I'm hungry, he told her. I hope I never have to do that again, Douglas told his lieutenant, not for the first time. How did it go? Well, that professor might make a formal complaint. I think I calmed him down enough, but you never know with people like that. Does Kelly know anything? Nothing we can use, Douglas replied. He's still too messed up from being shot and all to be coherent, but he didn't see any faces, didn't... Hell, if he had seen anything, he would probably have done something. I even showed him the picture, trying to shake him a little. I thought the poor bastard would have a heart attack. The doctor went crazy. I'm not real proud of that, Em. Nobody should have to see something like that. Including us, Tom. Including us. Lieutenant Emmett Ryan looked up from a large collection of photos, half taken at the scene, half at the coroner's office. What he saw there sickened him despite all his years of police work, especially because this wasn't a crime of madness or passion. No, this event had been done for a purpose by coldly rational men. I talked to Frank. This Kelly guy is a good scout. Helped him clear the Gooding case. He's not linked up with anything. The doctors all say that he's clean, not a user. Anything on the girl?
Douglas didn't need to say that this could have been the break they'd needed. If only Kelly had called them instead of Alan, who didn't know about their investigation. But he hadn't, and their best potential source of information was dead.
The prince came back, Pamela Madden. She was picked up in Chicago, Atlanta, and New Orleans for prostitution. Never came to trial, never did any time. The judges just kept letting her go. Victimless crime, right?
The sergeant suppressed a curse at the many idiots on the bench.
Sure am, no victims at all. So we're not any closer to these people than we were 6 months ago, are we?
We need more manpower, Douglas said, stating the obvious.
To chase down the murder of a street hooker? The lieutenant asked.
The mayor didn't like the picture, but they've already told him what she was, and after a week things go back to normal.
You think we'll break something loose in a week, Tom?
You could let him know.
No.
Ryan shook his head. He'd talk. Ever know a politician who didn't?
They've got somebody inside this building, Tom.
You want more manpower?
Tell me, where do we get it, the kind we can trust?
I know him. Douglas conceded the point.
But we're not getting anywhere.
Maybe narcotics will shake something loose.
Sure, Douglas snorted.
Can Kelly help us?
No, damn fool was just looking the wrong way.
Then do the usual follow-up, just to make sure everything looks okay, and leave it at that.
Forensics isn't in yet. Maybe they'll turn something.
Yes, sir, Douglas replied.
As so often happened in police work, you played for breaks, for mistakes the other side made. These people didn't make many, but sooner or later they all did, both officers told themselves. It was just that they never seemed to come soon enough.
Lieutenant Ryan looked back down at the photos.
They sure had their fun with her, just like the other one.
Good to see you're eating.
Kelly looked up from a mostly empty plate.
The cop was right, Sam. It's over. I have to get better, have to focus on something, right?
What are you going to do?
I don't know. Hell, I could always go back in the Navy or something.
You have to deal with your grief, John, Sam said, sitting down next to the bed.
I know how. I've had to do that before, remember?
He looked up.
Oh, what did you tell the police about me?
How we met, that sort of thing. Why?
What I did over there. It's secret, Sam.
Kelly managed to look embarrassed. The unit I belong to, it doesn't officially exist. The things we did, well, they never really happened, if you know what I mean.
They didn't ask.
Besides, you never really told me, the surgeon said, puzzled, even more so by the relief on his patient's face.
I got recommended to them by a pal in the Navy, mainly to help train their divers. What they know is what I'm allowed to tell. It's not what I really did exactly, but it sounds good.
Okay.
I haven't thanked you for taking such good care of me.
Rosen stood and walked to the door, but he stopped dead 3 feet short of it and turned.
You think you can fool me?
I guess not, Sam, Kelly answered guardedly.
John, I have spent my whole damned life using these hands to fix people. You have to stay aloof. You can't get too involved. Because if you do, you can lose it. Lose the edge. Lose the concentration. I've never hurt anyone in my life. You understand me?
Yes, sir, I do.
What are you going to do?
You don't want to know, Sam.
I want to help.
I really do, Rosen said, genuine wonder in his voice.
I liked her too, John.
I know that.
So what can I do? The surgeon asked.
He was afraid that Kelly might ask for something he was unfitted to do, more afraid still that he might agree.
Get me better.
Chapter 9. Labor.
It was almost grim to watch, Sandy thought. The strange thing was that he was being a good patient. He didn't whine. He didn't bitch. He did just what they told him to do.
There was a streak of the sadist in all physical therapists. There had to be, since the job meant pushing people a little further than they wanted to go, just as an athletic coach would do. And the ultimate aim was to help, after all. Even so, a good therapist had to push the patient, encourage the weak, and browbeat the strong, to cajole and to shame, all in the name of health. That meant taking satisfaction from the exertion and pain of others, and O'Toole could not have done that. But Kelly, she saw, would have none of it. He did what was expected, and when the therapist asked for more, more was delivered, and on, until the therapist was pushed beyond the point of pride in the result of his efforts and began to worry. "You can ease off now," he advised. "Why?" Kelly asked, somewhat breathlessly. "Your heart rate is 195, and had been there for 5 minutes." "What's the record?" "Zero," the therapist replied without a smile. That earned him a laugh and a look, and Kelly slowed his pace on the stationary bike, easing himself down over a period of 2 minutes to a reluctant stop. "I've come to take him back," O'Toole announced. "Good. Do that before he breaks something." Kelly got off and toweled his face, glad to see that she hadn't brought a wheelchair or something similarly insulting. "To what do I owe this honor, ma'am?" "I'm supposed to keep an eye on you," Sandy replied. "Trying to show us how tough you are?" Kelly had been a touch light-hearted, but turned serious. "Mrs. O'Toole, I'm supposed to get my mind off my troubles, right? Exercise does that for me. I can't run with one arm tied up, I can't do push-ups, and I can't lift weights. I can ride a bike, okay?" "You have me there, okay." She pointed to the door. Out in the bustling anonymity of the corridor, she said, "I'm very sorry about your friend." "Thank you, ma'am." He turned his head, slightly dizzy from the exertion, as they walked along in the crowd. "We have rituals in uniform. The bugle, the flag, the guys with rifles. It works fairly well for the men. It helps you to believe that it all meant something. It still hurts, but it's a formal way to say goodbye. We learned to deal with it. But what happened to you is different, and what just happened to me is different. So what did you do? Get more involved in work?" "I finished my master's. I'm a nurse practitioner. I teach. I worry about patients." And that was her whole life now. "Well, you don't have to worry about me, okay? I know my limits."
"Where are the limits?"
"A long way off," Kelly said, with the beginnings of a smile that he quickly extinguished. "How am I doing?"
"Very well."
It hadn't gone all that smoothly, and both knew it. Donald Madden had flown to Baltimore to claim the body of his daughter from the coroner's office, leaving his wife home, never meeting with anyone despite pleas from Sarah Rosen. He wasn't interested in talking to a fornicator, the man had said over the phone, a remark that Sandy knew about, but which neither medic had passed on. The surgeon had filled her in on the background of the girl, and it was merely a final sad chapter to a brief and sad life, something the patient didn't need to know. Kelly had asked about funeral arrangements, and both had told him that he would be unable to leave the hospital in any case. Kelly had accepted that in silence, surprising the nurse. His left shoulder was still immobilized, and there had to be pain, the nurse knew. She and others could see the occasional wince, especially close to the time for a new pain medication. But Kelly wasn't the type to complain. Even now, still breathing hard from a murderous 30 minutes on the bike, he was making quite a point of walking as rapidly as he could, cooling himself down like a trained athlete.
"Why the big show?" she asked.
"I don't know. Does there have to be a reason for everything? It's the way I am, Sandy."
"Well, your legs are longer than mine. Slow down, okay?"
"Sure." Kelly eased off his pace as they reached the elevator.
"How many girls are there? Like Pam, I mean."
"Too many."
She didn't know the numbers. There were enough that they were noticed as a class of patient, enough that you knew they were there.
"Who helps them?"
The nurse pushed the elevator button.
"Nobody. They're starting up programs for dealing with the drug habits, but the real problems, the abusive backgrounds and what comes from it, there's a new term now, behavioral disorder. If you're a thief, there are programs. If you abuse kids, there's a program. But girls like that are outcasts. Nobody does much of anything. The only people who deal with that are church groups. If somebody said it was a disease, maybe people would pay attention.
Is it a disease?
John, I'm not a doctor, just a nurse practitioner, and it's outside my field anyway. I do post-op care for surgical patients.
Okay, we talk over lunch, and I know a little.
It's surprising how many of them show up dead. Drug overdoses, accidental or deliberate, who can say? Or they meet the wrong person, or their pimp gets a little too rough, and they show up here. And their underlying medical problems don't help very much. And a lot of them just don't make it. Hepatitis from bad needles, pneumonia. Add that to a major injury, and it's a deadly combination. But is anybody going to do anything about it? O'Toole looked down as the elevator arrived. Young people aren't supposed to die that way.
Yeah.
Kelly gestured for her to get in the elevator first.
You're the patient, she objected.
You're the lady, he insisted. Sorry, it's the way I was raised.
Who is this guy? Sandy asked herself.
She was managing the care of more than one patient, of course, but the professor had ordered her. Well, not exactly, she told herself, but a suggestion from Dr. Rosen carried a lot of weight, especially since she had great respect for him as a friend and counselor. To keep a special eye on him. It wasn't matchmaking, as she'd initially suspected. He was still too hurt, and so was she, though she would not admit it. Such a strange man. So like Tim in many ways, but much more guarded. A strange mixture of the gentle and the rough. She hadn't forgotten what she had seen the previous week, but it was gone now, and never a hint of it had returned. He treated her with respect and good humor, never once commenting on her figure, as many patients did, and to which she pretended to object. He was so unlucky and yet so purposeful. His furious effort in rehab, his outward toughness, how to reconcile that with his incongruous good manners.
"When will I get out?" Kelly asked in a voice that was light but not light enough.
"Another week," O'Toole replied, leading him off the elevator. "Tomorrow we unwrap your arm."
"Really? Sam didn't tell me."
"Then I can start using the arm again?"
"It's going to hurt when you do," the nurse warned.
"Hell, Sandy, it hurts already." Kelly grinned. "I might as well get some use out of the pain." "Lay down," the nurse ordered. Before he could object, she had a thermometer in his mouth and was taking his pulse. Then she checked his blood pressure. The numbers she put on the chart were 98.4, 64, and 105 over 60. The last two were especially surprising, she thought. Whatever else she might say about the patient, he was rapidly getting himself back into shape. She wondered what the urgency was.
"One more week," Kelly thought after she left. "Got to get this damned arm working."
"So, what have you found out for us?" Maxwell asked. "Good news and bad news," Greer replied. "The good news is that the opposition has very little in the way of regular ground forces within response distance of the objective. We have ID'd 3 battalions. 2 are training to go south. 1 just returned from I Corps. It's pretty beat up in the process of reconstituting. The usual TO&E. Not much in the way of heavy weapons. What mechanized formations they have are well away from here."
"And the bad news?" Admiral Podolsky asked.
"Do I have to tell you? Enough AAA along the coast to turn the sky black. SA-2 batteries here, here, and probably here, too. It's dangerous there for fast movers, Kaz. For helicopters? 1 or 2 rescue birds, sure, it's doable, but a large lift will be real dicey. We went all over this when we scoped out Kingpin, remember? It's only 30 miles from the beach. 15 or 20 minutes in a helo, flying in a straight line, which they will not be able to do, Kaz. I went over the threat maps myself. The best route I can identify, it's your area, Kaz, but I do know a little, okay, is 25 minutes, and I wouldn't want to fly it in daylight.
We can use 52s to blast a corridor through, Podolsky suggested. He'd never been the most subtle man in the world.
I thought you wanted to keep this small, Greer observed.
Look, the real bad news is that there isn't much enthusiasm for this kind of mission anywhere.
Kingpin failed.
That wasn't our fault, Podolsky objected.
I know that, Kaz, Greer said patiently.
Podolsky had always been a passionate advocate.
It ought to be doable, Kaz growled.
All three men hovered over the reconnaissance photos. It was a good collection, two from satellites, two from SR-71 Blackbirds, and three very recent low obliques from Buffalo Hunter drones. The camp was 200 meters square, an exact square, in fact, undoubtedly fitting exactly the diagram in some East Block manual for building secure facilities. Each corner had a guard tower, each of which was exactly 10 meters in height. Each tower had a tin roof to keep the rain off the NVA standard-issue RPD light machine gun, an obsolete Russian design. Inside the wire were three large buildings and two small ones. Inside one of the large buildings were, they believed, 20 American officers, all lieutenant colonel, commander rank, or higher, for this was a special camp. It was the Buffalo Hunter photos that had first come to Greer's attention. One was good enough to have identified a face, Colonel Robin Zacharias, USAF. His F-105G Wild Weasel had been shot down 8 months earlier. He and his weapons systems operator had been reported killed by the North Vietnamese. Even a picture of his body had been published. This camp, whose code name, Sender Green, was known to fewer than 50 men and women, was separate from the better-known Hanoi Hilton, which had been visited by American citizens, and where, since the spectacular but unsuccessful Operation Kingpin raid on the camp at Song Tay, nearly all American POWs had been concentrated. Out of the way, located in the most unlikely of places, not acknowledged in any way, Sender Green was ominous. However the war would turn out, America wanted her pilots back. Here was a place whose very existence suggested that some would never be returned. A statistical study of losses had shown an ominous irregularity. Flight officers of relatively high rank were reported killed at a higher rate than those of lower rank. It was known that the enemy had good intelligence sources, many of them within the American peace movement, that they had dossiers on senior American officers, who they were, what they knew, what other jobs they had held. It was possible that those officers were being held in a special place, that their knowledge was being used by North Vietnam as a bargaining chip for dealing with their Russian sponsors. The prisoners' knowledge in areas of special strategic interest was being traded, maybe, for continuing support from a sponsor nation that was losing interest in this lengthy war, with the new atmosphere of détente. So many games were going on.
Gutsy, Maxwell breathed.
The three blow-ups showed the man's face, each one staring straight at the camera. The last of the three caught one of his guards in the act of swinging a rifle butt into his back. The face was clear. It was Zacharias.
This guy is Russian, Casimir Podolsky said, tapping the drone photos. The uniform was unmistakable.
They knew what Kaz was thinking. The son of Poland's one-time ambassador to Washington, by heredity a count and scion of a family that had once fought at the side of King John Sobieski, his family had been extinguished on one side of the demarcation line by the Nazis along with the rest of the Polish nobility, and on the other by the Russians in Katyn Forest, where two brothers had been murdered after fighting a brief and futile two-front war. In 1941, the day after graduating Princeton University, Podolsky had joined the U.S. Navy as an aviator, adopting a new country and a new profession, both of which he had served with pride and skill. And rage. That was now all the more intense because soon he would be forced to retire. Greer could see the reason. His surprisingly delicate hands were gnarled with arthritis. Try as he might to conceal it, his next physical would down-check him for good. And Kaz would face retirement with memories of a dead son and a wife on antidepressant medications. After a career he would probably deem a failure, despite his medals and personal flag.
"We've got to find a way," Podolsky said. "If we don't, we'll never see these men again."
You know who might be there, Dutch? Pete Francis. Hank Osborne.
Pete worked for me when I had Enterprise, Maxwell acknowledged. Both men looked at Greer.
I concur in the nature of the camp.
I had my doubts. Zacharias, Francis, and Osborne are all names they'd be interested in.
The Air Force officer had spent a tour at Omaha, part of the joint targeting staff that selected the destinations for strategic weapons, and his knowledge of America's most secret war plans was encyclopedic. The two naval officers had similarly important information, and while each might be brave and dedicated and obstinately determined to deny, conceal, and disguise, they were merely men, and men had limits, and the enemy had time.
Look, if you want, I can try to sell the idea to some people, but I'm not very hopeful.
If we don't, we're breaking faith with our people.
Podolsky slammed his fist on the desk.
But Kaz had an agenda, too. Discovery of this camp, rescue of its prisoners, would make it explicitly clear that North Vietnam had publicly lied. That might poison the peace talks enough to force Nixon to adopt yet another optional plan being drawn up by a larger Pentagon working group, the invasion of the North. It would be that most American of military operations, a combined arms assault, without precedent for its daring, scope, and potential dangers. An airborne drop directly into Hanoi, a division of Marines hitting the beaches on both sides of Haiphong, airmobile assaults in the middle, supported by everything America could bring to bear in one massive, crushing attempt to break the North by capture of its political leadership. That plan, whose cover name changed on a monthly basis, currently it was Certain Cornet, was the holy grail of vengeance for all the professionals who had for 6 years watched their country blunder about in indecision and the profligate waste of America's children.
Don't you think I know that? Osborne worked for me at Suitland. I went with the chaplain when he delivered the fucking telegram, okay? I'm on your side, remember?
Unlike Kaz and Dutch, Greer knew that Certain Cornet would never be more than a staff study. It just couldn't happen, not without briefing Congress, and Congress had too many leaks. A possibility in 1966 or 67, maybe even as late as 1968, such an operation was unthinkable now. But Sender Green was still there, and this mission was possible. Just.
Cool down, Kaz, Maxwell suggested.
Yes, sir.
Greer shifted his gaze to the relief map.
You know, you Airedales kind of limit your thinking.
What do you mean? Maxwell asked.
Greer pointed to a red line that ran from a coastal town nearly to the camp's main gate. On the overhead photos, it looked like a good road, blacktopped and all.
The reaction forces are here, here, and here. The road's here. Follows the river most of the way up. There are flak batteries all over the place. The road supports them. But, you know, AAA isn't dangerous to the right sort of equipment.
That's an invasion, Podolsky observed.
And sending in two companies of airmobile troops isn't?
I've always said you were smart, James, Maxwell said. You know, this is right where my son was shot down.
That SEAL went in and recovered him right about here, the Admiral said, tapping the map.
Somebody who knows the area from ground level? Greer asked.
That's a help. Where is he?
Hi, Sarah.
Kelly waved her to the chair. She looked older, he thought.
This is my third time, John. You were asleep the other two.
I've been doing a lot of that. It's okay, he assured her. Sam's in here a couple times a day.
He was already uncomfortable. The hardest part was facing friends, Kelly told himself.
Well, we've been busy in the lab.
Sarah spoke rapidly.
John, I needed to tell you how sorry I am that I asked you to come into town. I could have sent you somewhere else. She didn't need to see Madge. There's a guy I know in Annapolis, perfectly good practitioner. Her voice stumbled on.
So much guilt, Kelly thought. None of this was your fault, Sarah, he said when she stopped talking. You were a good friend to Pam. If her mom had been like you, maybe...
It was almost as though she hadn't heard him.
I should have given you a later date, if the timing had been a little different.
She was right on that part, Kelly thought. The variables.
What if? What if he'd selected a different block to be parked on? What if Billy had never spotted him? What if I hadn't moved at all and let the bastard just go on his way? A different day? A different week? What if a lot of things? The past happened because 100 little random things had to fall exactly into place in exactly the right way, in exactly the proper sequence. And while it was easy to accept the good results, one could only rage at the bad ones. What if he'd taken a different route from the food warehouse? What if he'd not spotted Pam at the side of the road and never picked her up? What if he'd never spotted the pills? What if he hadn't cared? Or what if he'd been so outraged that he had abandoned her? Would she be alive now? If her father had been a little more understanding and she'd never run away, they would never have met. Was that good or bad? And if all that were true, then what did matter? Was everything a random accident? The problem was that you couldn't tell. Maybe if he were God looking down on everything from above, maybe then it would fit some pattern. But from the inside it merely was, Kelly thought. And you did the best you could. And you tried to learn from your mistakes for when the next random event happened to you. But did that make sense? Hell, did anything really make sense? That was far too complex a question for a former Navy chief lying in a hospital bed. Sarah, none of this is your fault. You helped her in the best way you could. How could you change that? Damn it, Kelly, we had her saved. I know. And I brought her here, and I got careless, not you. Sarah, everyone tells me it's not my fault, and then you come in here and tell me it's yours. The grimace was almost a smile. This can be very confusing, except for one thing. It wasn't an accident, was it? Sarah noted. No, it wasn't. There he is, Oreza said quietly, keeping his binoculars on the distant speck. Just like you said. Come to Papa, the policeman breathed in the darkness. It was just a happy coincidence, the officer told himself. The people in question owned a corn farm in Dorchester County, but between the corn rows were marijuana plants. Simple, as the saying went, but effective. With a farm came barns and outbuildings and privacy. Being clever people, they didn't want to drive their product across the Bay Bridge in their pickup truck, where the summer traffic was unpredictably interrupted. And, besides, a sharp-eyed toll-taker had helped the state police make a bust only a month before. They were careful enough to become a potential threat to his friend. That had to be stopped. So they used a boat. This heaven-sent coincidence gave the Coast Guard the chance to participate in a bust, and thus to raise his stature in their eyes. It couldn't hurt, after he'd used them as the stalking horse to help get Angelo Verano killed, Lieutenant Charon thought, smiling in the wheelhouse. "Take him now?" Oreza asked. "Yes. The people they're delivering to are under our control. Don't tell anybody that," he added. "We don't want to compromise them." "You got it." The quartermaster advanced his throttles and turned the wheel to starboard. "Let's wake up, people," he told his crew. The 41 boat squatted at the stern with the increased power. The rumble of the diesels was intoxicating to the boat's commander. The small steel wheel vibrated in his hands as he steadied up on his new course. The funny part was that it would come as a surprise to them. Although the Coast Guard was the principal law enforcement agency on the water, their main activity had always been search and rescue, and the word hadn't quite gotten out yet. Which, Oreza told himself, was just too goddamn bad. He'd found a few Coast Guardsmen smoking pot in the past couple of years, and his wrath was something still talked about by those who'd seen it. The target was easily seen now, a 30-foot bay-built fishing boat of the sort that dotted the Chesapeake, probably with an old Chevy engine, and that meant she couldn't possibly outrun his cutter. It was a perfectly good thing to have a good disguise, Oreza thought with a smile, but not so clever to bet your life and your freedom on one card, however good it might be. "Just let everything look normal," the policeman said quietly. "Look around, sir," the quartermaster replied.
The boat crew was alert, but not obviously so, and their weapons were holstered. The boat's course was almost a direct one toward their Thomas Point station, and if the other boat even took note of them, and nobody was looking aft at the moment, they could easily assume that the 41-footer was just heading back to the barn. 500 yards now. Areza jammed the throttles to the stops to get the extra knot or two of overtake speed. "There's Mr. English," another crewman said. The other 41 boat from Thomas Point was on a reciprocal course, outbound from the station, holding steady on a straight line, roughly towards the lighthouse that the station also supported. "Not real smart, are they?" Areza asked. "Well, if they were smart, why break the law?" "Roger that, sir." 300 yards now, and a head turned aft to see the gleaming white shape of the small cutter. Three people aboard the target craft, and the one who had looked at them leaned forward to say something to the guy at the wheel. It was almost comical to watch. Areza could imagine every word they were saying. "There's a Coast Guard boat back there. So just play it cool. Maybe they're just changing the duty boat or something. See the one there? Uh-oh, I don't like this. Just be cool, damn it. I really don't like this. Settle down, their lights aren't on, and their station is right down there, for Christ's sake." "Just about time," Areza smiled to himself. "Just about time for... oh, shit." He grinned when it happened. The guy at the wheel turned, and his mouth opened and shut, having said just that. One of the younger crewmen read the man's lips and laughed. "I think they just figured it out, Skipper. Hit the lights," the quartermaster ordered, and the cop lights atop the wheelhouse started blinking, somewhat to Areza's displeasure. "Aye, aye." The bay boat turned rapidly south, but the outbound cutter turned to cover the maneuver, and it was instantly clear that neither could outrun the twins' crew 41 boats. "Should have used the money to buy something sportier, boys," Areza said to himself, knowing that criminals learned from their mistakes, too. And buying something to outrun a 41-foot patrol boat was not exactly a taxing problem. This one was easy. Chasing another little sailboat would be easy, if this damned fool of a cop would let them do it right, but the easy ones wouldn't last forever. The bayboat cut power, trapped between two cutters. Warrant Officer English kept station a few hundred yards out while Areza drove in close. "Howdy," the quartermaster said over his loud hailer. "This is the U.S. Coast Guard, and we are exercising our right to board and conduct a safety inspection. Let's everybody stay where we can see you, please." It was remarkably like watching people who'd just lost a pro football game. They knew they couldn't change anything, no matter what they did. They knew that resistance was futile, and so they just stood there in dejection and acceptance of their fate. Areza wondered how long that would last. How long before somebody would be dumb enough to fight it out? Two of his sailors jumped aboard, covered by two more on the 41's fantail. Mr. English brought his boat in closer. A good boat handler, Areza saw, like a warrant was supposed to be. And he had his people out to offer cover, too, just in case the bad guys got a crazy idea. While the three men stood in plain view, mostly looking down at the deck and hoping that it might really be a safety inspection, Areza's two men went into the forward cabin. Both came out in less than a minute. One tipped the bill of his cap, signaling all clear, then patted his belly. Yes, there were drugs aboard. 5 pats. A lot of drugs aboard.
"We have a bust, sir," Areza observed calmly.
Lieutenant Mark Charon of the Narcotics Division, Baltimore City Police Department, leaned against the doorframe. Hatch, whatever these sailors called the thing, and smiled. He was dressed in casual clothes, and might have easily been mistaken for a coastie with the required orange life jacket. "You handle it, then. How does it go in the books?"
"Routine safety inspection, and, golly, they had drugs aboard," Areza said in mock surprise.
"Exactly right, Mr. Areza." "Thank you, sir."
"My pleasure, Captain."
He'd already explained the procedure to Areza and English. In order to protect his informants, credit for the arrest would go to the coasties, which didn't exactly displease the quartermaster or the warrant officer. Areza would get to paint a victory symbol on his mast, or whatever they called the thing the radar was attached to, a representation of the five-leafed marijuana plant, and the crewmen would have something to brag about. They might even have the adventure of testifying before a federal district court. Probably not, since these small-timers would undoubtedly cop to the smallest offense their attorney could negotiate. They would get word out that the people to whom they were making the delivery had probably informed on them. With luck, those people might even disappear, and that would really make his task easy. There would be an opening in the drug ecostructure, another new buzzword Charon had picked up on. At the very least, a potential rival in that ecostructure was now out of business for good. Lieutenant Charon would get a pat on the back from his captain, probably a flowery thank-you letter from the United States Coast Guard and the U.S. Attorney's Office, not to mention congratulations for running such a quiet and effective operation that had not compromised his informants. "One of our best men," his captain would affirm again. "How do you get informants like that?" "Cap'n, you know how that works. I have to protect these people." "Sure, Mark. I understand. You just keep up the good work." "I'll do my best, sir," Charon thought to himself, staring off at the setting sun. He didn't even watch the coasties cuffing the suspects, reading them their constitutional rights from the plastic-coated card, smiling as they did so, since for them this was a very entertaining game. But then that's what it was for Charon, too. "Where were the damned helicopters?" Kelly asked himself. Everything about the damned mission had been wrong from the first moment. Pickett, his usual companion, had come down with violent dysentery. Too bad for him to go out, and Kelly had gone out alone. Not a good thing, but the mission was too important, and they had to cover every little hamlet or ville. So he'd come in alone, very, very carefully moving up the stinking water of this, well, the map called it a river, but it wasn't quite large enough for Kelly to think of it that way. And, of course, this is the ville they'd come to, the fuckers. Plastic Flower, he thought, watching and listening. Who the hell came up with that name? Plastic Flower was the code name for an NVA political action team, or whatever they called it. His team had several other names, none of them complimentary. Certainly they weren't the precinct workers he'd seen on election day in Indianapolis. Not these people, schooled in Hanoi on how to win hearts and minds. The Ville's headman, chief, mayor, whatever the hell he was just a little too courageous to be called anything but a fool. He was paying for that foolishness before the distant eyes of bosun's mate, First Class J.T. Kelly. The team had arrived at 0130, and in a very orderly and almost civilized way, entered every little hooch, awakening the whole population of farmers, bringing them into the common area to see the misguided hero and his wife and his three daughters all waiting for them, sitting in the dirt, their arms cruelly tied behind their backs. The NVA major who led Plastic Flower invited them all to sit in a mannerly voice that reached Kelly's observation point less than 200 meters away. The Ville needed a lesson in the foolishness of resistance to the People's Liberation Movement. It was not that they were bad people, just misguided, and he hoped that this simple lesson would make clear to them the error of their ways. They started with the man's wife. That took 20 minutes. "I have to do something," he told himself. "There's 11 of them, idiot." And while the major might be a sadistic motherfucker, the 10 soldiers with him had not been selected exclusively for their political correctness. They would be reliable, experienced, and dedicated soldiers. How a man could be dedicated to such things as this, Kelly didn't have the imagination to understand. That they were was a fact that he could not afford to ignore. Where was the fucking reaction team? He'd called in 40 minutes earlier, and the support base was only 20 minutes off by chopper. They wanted this major. His team might also be useful, but they wanted the major alive. He knew the location of the local political leaders, those the Marines hadn't swept up in a superb raid 6 weeks earlier. This mission was probably a reaction to that, a deliberate response so close to the American base to say that, no, you hadn't gotten us all yet, and you never will. and they were probably right, Kelly thought. But that question went far beyond the mission for tonight.